In the morning, Mrs. Harvey returned. The president said good morning, pointed to a chair, seemed annoyed at something, and waited for her to speak. She waited for him. "Well?" said he after a minute of delay. "Well?" replied his visitor. He looked up under his eyebrows, a little startled, and inquired, "Have you nothing to say?" "Nothing," she replied, "until I hear your decision. Have you decided? You know you bade me come this morning." "No, I have not decided, and I believe this idea of northern hospitals is a great humbug, and I am tired of hearing about it." The woman pitied him in his weak and irritable mood. "I regret to add a feather's weight to your already overwhelming care and responsibility. I would rather have stayed at home." With a feeble smile, he responded, "I wish you had." Wisconsin's former first lady, the widow Cordelia Harvey, encountered an exasperated Abraham Lincoln on that day in 1862, but she got the military hospitals she wanted for Wisconsin soldiers, and by the end of the Civil War, more than 90,000 Wisconsin men had served in the Union Army. What were their motives? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were the prominent attitudes of Wisconsinites about abolition and slavery? Why was the Republican Party born in Wisconsin? Why did many Germans in Wisconsin not support Lincoln? And how did the war change Wisconsin? Our guest is Erica Janik, author of the books Madison, A History of a Model City, A Short History of Wisconsin, and Odd Wisconsin.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Before we get to the details about Wisconsin in the Civil War, can you stand back from it a minute and just tell me how important is Wisconsin to the Civil War story?
Wisconsin actually plays a pretty important role in the Civil War. Some of the events leading up to the war were kind of ironic in a way. Wisconsin actually was a fierce advocate of states' rights, but actually against slavery in the 1850s. And, you know, states' rights is really what the Civil War was about. But the South took it the opposite way. They went with for slavery. And Wisconsin men and women sometimes in disguise, did serve as soldiers in the Union Army. Many of our generals were very distinguished. Our units really fought heroically, served in every single battle in the Civil War. Slaves escaped through Wisconsin. So Wisconsin does, you know, we don't think of it necessarily as a major player in the Civil War, but Wisconsin men and women were there. They were serving, they were fighting, and they were supporting the Union.
What kind of attitudes existed towards slavery in Wisconsin prior to the Civil War?
Before the war, a lot of Wisconsinites weren't really that concerned about slavery. Slavery seemed like it was something far away and in the South. But by the 1850s, a lot more people in Wisconsin started paying attention to slavery and started caring about it. And part of that was because a lot of Wisconsin's early settlers were from New England and New York, and these were areas that were hotbeds of reform and where a lot of abolitionists were from. And so they all come to Wisconsin and they bring their abolitionist sentiment with them. And so that kind of fired a lot of abolitionist belief here in Wisconsin. In 1842, before Wisconsin even became a state, we had an anti-slavery society. So people were starting to, like, slowly pay attention to it. And that's also, Wisconsin actually, some Southerners moved to Wisconsin and actually brought their slaves with them. So it wasn't like slavery was completely unknown to Wisconsin, but on the whole, it was for a while, up until the 1850s, something that we weren't terribly concerned about.
The 1840s were still a little early for that progressive tradition to sink into Wisconsin. But it's one thing to have laws against slavery to be a free state, and it's another to actually have a progressive attitude toward blacks. And so what was the status of blacks in Wisconsin other than not being slaves?
Well, actually, pretty good in some ways. When Wisconsin was when we were writing our Constitution, one of the things that was fiercely debated was whether African Americans should have the right to vote. And there were many people who thought that they should, and there were others that thought that they shouldn't. And they ended up deciding in our 1848 Constitution to put it up to a popular vote. And in 1849, Wisconsin residents actually did say that black people could have the right to vote. But despite voting for that, it was very difficult for African Americans to actually exercise that right. There was a lot of disagreement about what constituted a majority and whether that actually, you know, whether the vote, you know, just because we said we would let them vote, does that actually mean we will? So, you know, even though we were taking kind of these slightly more progressive stance towards African Americans than in other parts of the country, it was still pretty difficult to be a black person in Wisconsin. But there were also not as many of them. You know, African Americans didn't really start coming to Wisconsin in great numbers until the 20th century. So in some ways, people could be progressive about a people that they didn't really see a lot in their daily lives.
One of the controversial things happening around 1850 is the fugitive slave law and you know, what happens if you have a slave in one state travel into another state? Are you required to send them back? Can you say something about, first of all, what that act was put in place to stop and then how Wisconsin played a role in it?
Well, the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was basically a law to help slave owners. If their slaves tried to escape, then in the North, where slavery wasn't allowed, you know, a lot of slaves took that as an opportunity. They thought they could get to the North and then they'd be free. But this act basically said if you as a Northerner saw a slave that had escaped, you needed to return them to their master. It was that master's property. And so it was your responsibility and it was the responsibility of those states to enforce slavery, even if slavery was not allowed in that state. And this really, Wisconsin kind of took an interesting role in this whole fugitive slave debate. There was a man named Joshua Glover who'd been a slave in Missouri, and he actually escaped to Wisconsin living in Racine in 1854, and his master came after him. And so Glover was locked up in jail. But there were a lot of people in Wisconsin, abolitionist sentiment is beginning to rise in the 1850s, who thought that this was crazy. And so they got together. They were led by this man named Sherman Booth, who becomes kind of a abolitionist troublemaker in Wisconsin and a hero to many. He kind of led the charge to break Joshua Glover out of this prison, and they helped him escape to freedom in Canada. And for this, Booth was actually arrested for violating the Federal Fugitive Slave Act. But Booth actually took the case all the way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and they actually found in his favor. They voted for states' rights. Slavery was not allowed in Wisconsin, and so they were not going to enforce this act. And so, you know, Wisconsin decides in 1855 basically to nullify this federal act.
So, under the rubric of states' rights.
That's right. Yep.
And then Sherman Booth, it was considered it was okay for him to have organized this break from jail.
Yeah. They were really seeing him as, you know, kind of being this freedom fighter, that he was fighting for the rights of people, both white and black, and that he was fighting for states' rights. So it really did become kind of okay, the fact that he broke this federal law.
And how did that go over on the national scene?
Well, a lot of northern states, you know, Sherman Booth really became kind of a national hero, became very well known among abolitionist circles for his advocacy of slaves' rights. Of course, people in the South were none too pleased with Wisconsin's decision. But, you know, at this time, like, the clouds of war are kind of already forming. And so it's kind of the predictable result. In the North, they're like, go Wisconsin. And in the South, Wisconsin is not their favorite state.
What part did Wisconsin actually play in the formation of the Republican Party? Was it just more or less chance that it was formed in Wisconsin in, what, 1854?
Well, I don't want to disparage or, you know, question Ripon's status as the founder of the Republican Party. Actually, the Republican Party, there were many meetings being held all over the North. One of them in Ripon in 1854, this lawyer named Alvin Beauvais, he organized a meeting to talk about what to do about slavery. And one of the reasons that they were organizing is because there was this act that was introduced by a Democratic senator in Illinois named Stephen Douglas. And he had proposed something called the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And this would allow slavery or not in Kansas and Nebraska. And it was kind of a refutation of this, the 1820 Missouri Compromise, which had outlawed slavery in the North. But Douglas's act would have put whether slavery was going to be allowed or not up to the people who were actually living in that area. This really angered a lot of people. There was also a provision in the bill that said that non-citizen immigrants were not allowed to vote or hold office. This was a really contentious issue in Wisconsin because a lot of immigrants were coming over to the state, really causing the population to boom. And so not allowing these immigrants to have any rights was a big problem. So these were the kind of the issues that were swirling that led to these meetings in 1854. And so one of them was held in Ripon in the spring. And they were trying to decide, should we form a new party? So a lot of representatives from other parties came and met with this Beauvais. In July of 1854, they decided they had another meeting in Madison, and they actually decided to form a party, which they called the Republicans. And the Wisconsin Republicans were really kind of a, like Republicans everywhere at that time, were kind of a one-issue party. They were, you know, they were people from all these different groups coming together. A lot of them were Whigs, and Whigs had been really pro-economic reform, been a pretty prominent party in the early years of the 19th century. But, you know, they couldn't really agree on much else, so they just kind of became, we're anti-slavery. That's what the Republicans
are
about.
That was it.
Yep.
Anti-slavery.
And the terms we now use of Democrat and Republican don't really help us here when we're talking about the early Republican Party.
That's right. The parties have evolved to be very different than how they began. I mean, even just the idea of parties themselves have changed a lot since, you know, even the Constitution. A party in the beginning of our nation didn't quite mean the same thing as it was then. And so I think, you know, the parties that we think of now as Democrats and Republicans are really more of a 20th century invention.
I'm trying to think of another instance. I don't think there's one where a party founded in 1 year, within 6 years, has a president in the White House.
I know. It's pretty incredible. Yeah, they really, you know, I think it really shows, though, how that anti-slavery sentiment was really a galvanizing issue. You know, Wisconsin has a Republican governor in 1855, 1 year after that party is formed. There's all kinds of legislators from Wisconsin that are Republicans. You know, they really found that single issue that was enough to propel them into the presidency.
Was it mostly the Yankees and New Englanders living in Wisconsin, or was there any kind of immigrant groundswell behind the Republican Party?
It was a lot of the New Englanders and the Yankees. Wisconsin was really, despite having this huge influx of immigrants that really started happening in the 1840s and 1850s, Wisconsin had been originally settled by these Yankees and New Englanders, and they continued to kind of hold on to political power in the state. But there still were a lot of immigrants that were supportive of the Republicans, but there were also immigrants that weren't. In particular, the German Catholics were really did not like the Republican Party. They did not like Lincoln. And part of it really had to do with something separate from slavery a little bit, and this was these nativist issues. You know, the influx of immigrants made a lot of people nervous. And so there had been a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment across the country, and they kind of saw the Republican Party as just part and parcel of this anti-immigrant sentiment. And they also, you know, they being Catholics, they saw Lincoln and the Republican Party as a real Protestant institution. And so, you know, I think Protestant immigrants were Republicans and Catholic immigrants often were not.
What kind of role did Wisconsin play in the Underground Railroad?
Actually, a pretty prominent role. One of the first slaves that we know to go through Wisconsin was a woman named Caroline Quarles, and she came through in 1842. She, you know, had kind of the stories you hear about, like she hid in a pickle barrel overnight. She was secreted from house to house. A man named Lyman Goodenow eventually brought her to Canada, went on a 5-week trip. It's pretty, you know, incredible.
And wasn't she only like 16 or
yeah,
something
like
that?
Yeah, she was a teenager. Too? I believe she was 15 or 16 years old. So a young girl trying to make her way to freedom, and that there were these people that were really willing to put themselves on the line to help these slaves. Joshua Glover, the one I mentioned earlier, was another slave who came through. We know of at least a dozen more slaves who came through Wisconsin, probably more that nothing was written about, because it was pretty dangerous to admit that you were helping slaves, even in a state where slavery was not allowed.
And how did it work? Like, do we know some of the places and people that provided the transport?
Yeah, we don't. You know, there's a house in Milton, Wisconsin, in Rock County, that was known as a place where the Underground Railroad house, where they would have, you know, a secret passageway or places where they were known to be safe. It was basically kind of this informal network of people that were known to be abolitionists, that were known to offer safe harbor. And so you would just travel from house to house to house, and they would try to figure out how to get you out of the state. What's kind of interesting is a lot of these slaves would come up to Wisconsin, but then the actual route into Canada would be down through Illinois, then into Michigan, and crossing at Detroit into Windsor into freedom.
Which would make for a pretty long trip indeed.
Yep.
So when the South starts to secede, do we get a lot of unionist sentiment in Wisconsin? I mean, does unionism start to trump abolition as an issue?
Definitely. I think people are really concerned about preserving the nation and fighting for the Union cause. Our governor at the time, Alexander Randall, you know, had troops ready to go. He was ready to meet the call for troops. And we had no trouble getting volunteers in those first years of the war. And the governor actually sent an agent along with all of them to, like, kind of watch out for their health and safety. And that's pretty unusual.
Yes.
Not a lot of other states did anything like that. But he was very concerned that, you know, the Wisconsin soldiers are going to be healthy and they're going to fight for this Union. And we're going to do a good job and we're going to make Wisconsin proud.
What kind of relationship did Wisconsin have with Lincoln?
A pretty good one. You know, I think Lincoln had come to Wisconsin several times before the Civil War. He fought in the Black Hawk War. He had spoken in Wisconsin. So I think people were generally supportive. You know, the people we spoke about before, some of the German Catholics didn't love Lincoln. But I think on the whole, a lot of people were really proud of Lincoln, really fell into line behind him and believed that he would see us through.
What did Wisconsin send to the war effort other than men?
We sent several women. We sent a lot of women as nurses. A lot of women volunteered to go work in hospitals. Some women dressed up as men and went as soldiers. You know, we know about these people from sometimes they admitted it later, or some people kept diaries of their time. We also sent supplies, even people that didn't go. There was basically a constant stream of medical supplies and food being sent down to soldiers and to hospitals. That's really what women were doing on the home front. They were kind of charged with taking care of men while they were really far away. So women would get together. A lot of these middle-class women would get together and make bandages and prepare care packages that would then be delivered to the soldiers.
That lead from the lead part of the state turned into bullets for
That's
the
right,
Union?
That's right, yep. Yep, we definitely supplied a lot of manufacturing assistance, too. We also supplied a lot of food.
Would have been wheat, a lot of wheat at this point in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's right. Wisconsin had actually been a major wheat-producing state. We were supplying 1/6 of the nation's wheat before the Civil War. People referred to Wisconsin as the nation's breadbasket, which can be hard to believe when we're now America's dairyland. But I think, you know, once the war broke out, a lot of the food that the Union soldiers would have gotten from the South was no longer an option. So the Midwest was really supplying a lot of food to keep the armies going. And this wheat in Wisconsin was very important. Prices started skyrocketing for wheat. So farmers were doing very well, actually, with the war. The only problem with some of this was that a lot of these farmers were also soldiers. So there was huge labor shortages on these farms at the very same time that we needed to be sending all of this food off to the war effort. So again, a lot of women really picked up the reins that their men had dropped and started working in farm fields. And some of them had never worked in a field before. A lot of the women, particularly from New England and New York, were, you know, they took care of the house and maybe tended a garden in the backyard, but they certainly hadn't been out planting wheat before or harvesting it. But they still, you know, went out there and kept the wheat going out and, you know, really kept Wisconsin producing.
No, Wisconsin would have been pretty much at the end of the rail lines at that point, wouldn't it? And gone up, what, as far as Pardeeville maybe,
yep,
and then up toward La Crosse, but not much beyond that.
Right. So, yeah, you know, railroad traffic was really booming. You're right. We were totally at the end of the line, so we could load all of our things on it and send them to the east where those supplies were needed, both food and lead, as you mentioned. And other manufacturing, clothes. Milwaukee was just kind of beginning its manufacturing. There were a lot of small shops that were producing things that were needed for the war.
You got to wonder if some of the beer didn't make it down that way, too.
And how much choice did Wisconsin have in how involved it was in the Civil War? In other words, if you've got lots of soldiers being sent, lots of supplies, how much of that is a Wisconsin governor choice and how much is a national demand?
I think it worked both ways. I think there were a lot of people that readily volunteered their services and their time. But I think as the war dragged on, it became a little bit harder to find some of these things. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning of the war, we had no trouble supplying men. But in 1862, Lincoln gets this act called the Militia Act, which basically authorizes him to institute a draft if he needs more people. Because we were really having trouble all over the country getting enough people because the war had been going on at this point, you know, for almost 2 years, and a lot of people were dying. So there were some of it became compulsory, and this draft actually led to riots in several parts of Wisconsin, particularly among those German Catholics who partly fled their homeland because they were trying to escape compulsory military service. And here they are in their new land that they thought they'd be free and allowed to do what they want. And now they're being told they have to serve in the military again. So one of the worst riots actually happened in Port Washington in November of 1862. And 300 rioters basically attacked the draft office and started damaging the homes of Union soldiers, and they actually had to call in troops to calm it down. There was another draft riot in Milwaukee. So there was resistance to actually fighting. You know, some people really wanted to not be involved. But I think on the whole, there was still this very patriotic fervor that kind of was the dominant feeling.
There's such a rich trove of Civil War era diaries, and we seem to hear more from the South for some reason than from the North. What do we have representing Wisconsin?
We actually have quite a number. I think, again, because Wisconsin doesn't often figure into conversations about the Civil War, so you don't necessarily hear from the men and women who were writing letters and keeping diaries during the war. We have diaries from soldiers that fought in the war. We have diaries from nurses, rich collections of recollections and letters from all of these people. One of the best diaries we actually have is this Madison school teacher, Emily Quiner. She basically started keeping a journal the day the war broke out, and she writes in it every single day some really beautiful and poignant passages about what the war was doing to Madison and what she saw happening all around her. And then 2 years into the war, she and her sister decide that they're not really doing enough for the war effort, that they feel like they're kind of removed being here in Madison. And so they decide to go to Tennessee. And in Tennessee, they start working in a hospital, and she writes really lovely accounts that are very sad about what she's seeing all around her, and I think made the war more real in a way that, you know, she couldn't quite get a grasp on back home in Wisconsin.
July 4th, 1861. Wakened this morning by firing of guns and ringing of bells. Saw the procession go by our house at 12 o'clock, the chief features of which were the 34 girls in red, white, and blue to represent the states, and nearly 2,000 soldiers representing the 5th and 6th regiments quartered here. Went up to Ski Park for a little while, heard the Declaration read and the commencement of the nation. Came home and a short walk in the evening finished my outdoor performances for the day. This 4th is an important one to us all. And who could look upon the 2,000 brave men who pass through our streets today, volunteers to defend our liberty, and not feel his patriotism swell within him? Our country is shrouded and darkened by this cloud of civil war. But trusting in God as our help and strength, and as the supporter of the cause of right, we shall yet see the clear sky over our heads, and the light of peace and fraternity bearing upon us. July 9th, 1863. Rose this morning at the sound of the bugle at 5, dressed and went down to my ward, went around and said good morning to all my men, attended to the giving out of breakfast, fed one man. There are some who are very sick. One man was having fits when I entered the ward yesterday. He had them at intervals all through the night, and they think he will not live through the day. After breakfast, the surgeon came, and I made out the diet list for the day under his directions. I stayed in my ward nearly all day. At night, I was so tired, and my feet were so swelled that I could not sleep. There is a great deal of noise in the street, and sleeping in strange rooms is not just the thing for nervous people. July 13th, 1863. Went to my ward as usual. Men getting along very well. Did not go out tonight. One of my men, very sick. He cannot live. He's an Ohio boy. A very fine fellow, about 20 years old. I would almost give the world if he could live. I wrote a letter to a cousin of his in the army at Vicksburg, telling him how he was and asking him to write home and inform his friends. He's very grateful for anything I do for him, and though he never says much, his eyes follow me everywhere. He's very homesick. How my heart aches when I think that this is the way that the flower of our country's youth are perishing in this cruel contest.
I am thankful that God has given me the opportunity to do some good, and pray that he will give me strength to do my duty faithfully in the fear of his holy name. Tired out tonight. Went to bed with a heavy heart.
That was Michelle Good reading from the diary of Emily Quiner, a Madison resident who became a nurse ministering to Wisconsin soldiers during the Civil War. And we'll look further at how the troops, the Wisconsin troops, fared in the Civil War when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Erica Janik, who is giving us some background on Wisconsin, its people, and its resources in the Civil War. Well, you have to muster those troops once the president calls for them, either volunteers or drafts. And so who are the military leaders that emerge in Wisconsin?
Well, there's several of them. Some of them became, you know, pretty prominent citizens in Wisconsin after the war, too. Lucius Fairchild lost an arm during the Civil War, became our governor. Colonel Haig, who stands outside of the Capitol here in Madison, actually led the 15th Wisconsin, an amusing regiment, despite the fact that they were obviously at war and Colonel Haig didn't make it out of the war. But there were a lot of these regiments in Wisconsin that were all one ethnic group. And Colonel Haig, Hans Christian Haig, was a Norwegian, and he led a group of Norwegians. There were about 900 people in his regiment, and so many of them were named Ole that they had to actually number them.
Ole 1 and Ole 2. And,
yep. Yeah. Yeah, I think in his diary he says something about there being 200 men named Ole. So
wow.
The perils of having a single ethnic group.
And was that choice made to have a single ethnic group as a sort of, I mean, was it in a certain way a kind of, I don't know, a kind of prejudice, sort of thinking everybody should be the same and, you know, keep out the ones who didn't fit?
Or were they just drawing geographically and there happened to be a lot of Norwegians in that part of the state?
Yeah, they were really doing it geographically. I mean, a lot of immigrants were settling in Wisconsin in single ethnic group communities. You know, that's why we have these communities like New Glarus, where there's lots of Swiss. And so they were, you know, this 15th Wisconsin was basically made up of an area of Wisconsin where there were a lot of Norwegians settling. So you'll find all Irish regiments, usually coming from Milwaukee, same with all German groups. So yeah, it was really drawn. It was towns coming together and forming a regiment. That's basically how all of these Civil War groups would form. So they kind of organized themselves by ethnic group. It wasn't necessarily that there was any prejudice involved, though I'm sure that actually did play some role in it, because I can imagine that, you know, some of these immigrants wouldn't want to be, some of the Protestants wouldn't want to be with the Catholics and vice versa.
I find it interesting that the statistic you mentioned earlier that Wisconsin soldiers fought in every major battle of the Civil War and that there were more than 90,000 men serving in 56 regiments. That's a pretty huge contribution to the war.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, really, if you lived in Wisconsin in the Civil War, you didn't have a family member who wasn't affected by it. You didn't have a brother or a father or a son who wasn't fighting in the Civil War. So it really was something that touched everyone, whether you agreed with the war or not. And, you know, there were also, and, you know, in addition to those German Catholics, there were also Democrats still, besides the Republicans, that didn't think that, you know, we should be fighting this war. So I think, but there was no way that you couldn't be touched by it economically or personally.
Here in Madison, we see Camp Randall Stadium when we're passing on the way to campus. Tell us about the role that played in the war.
Yeah, so Camp Randall was not always a football stadium. It actually, before the war, it was a fairground. And then during the Civil War, they converted it into the major training facility for Civil War soldiers in Wisconsin. More than 90% of Wisconsin soldiers passed through Camp Randall at some point. There were other training facilities in Milwaukee, Fond du Lac, Racine. But really, Camp Randall was the main area. It was a large area. They built a bunch of buildings. In addition to being a training facility, it was actually a Confederate prison, too. Prisoners that they had captured, the Union soldiers had captured, would be brought back to Camp Randall.
Island number 10 in the Mississippi River being a source of a lot of them.
Right. So, you know, I think that's something, too, that we don't think about, that there were Confederates here and that there are Confederates buried in Wisconsin.
Quite a few. There's 120 in Madison.
I think
it qualifies as the northernmost Confederate cemetery in the country.
I think it does, too. That's what I've heard as well. So, you know, I think there's an interesting, you know, again, things we don't think about in Wisconsin in the Civil War, that there could have been Confederates actually in this state. Camp Randall's also interesting, too, because people in Madison weren't necessarily thrilled to have this training facility here in town. If you can imagine a bunch of young men with not a lot to do during the day and the night, you know, they'd do their drills, but they'd just kind of be hanging out, waiting for the next battle to happen. And so they were often skipping out of the training facility and kind of wreaking havoc all over downtown.
They chopped down all the trees on University Heights for firewood.
Right. You know, there'd be bar fights. There were several murders that were attributed to soldiers getting in arguments with people. So I think, you know, in some ways, people in Madison were grateful for the war to be over for several reasons, one of them being that there wouldn't be so many young men with not much to do housed at Camp Randall.
And I've heard of the Iron Brigade as one of the famous regiments from Wisconsin. What made it well known?
Well, the Iron Brigade fought in the Army of the Potomac, and they were involved. They were one of the earliest regiments to form, and they suffered kind of unusually high numbers of casualties. That's in some ways an unfortunate way to become well known. They got their name because General George B. McClellan, who was the lead general of the Union Army, he had seen them advancing into battle under basically like a murderous onslaught, and he said that those men must be made of iron because they just kept going. And that's kind of how they became known, that they would just keep going, even though they were losing tremendous numbers of men at Gettysburg and Antietam, two of the bloodiest battles in the Civil War anyway, basically decimated the Iron Brigade. But they, you know, were heroes in Wisconsin and heroes nationally.
You have an account from a prisoner at Gettysburg, right? What does he have to say?
Yeah, I have there's a man, his name is Nathaniel Rollins. He was in the 2nd Wisconsin, and things in Gettysburg didn't turn out so well for him. He was actually taken prisoner by the Confederates, and he was brought to probably the most notorious and perhaps well-known Confederate prisons, which is Libby Prison in Richmond, Virginia. And he was kept there for 2 years. And when he was let go, he wrote this reminiscence about 2 weeks after he got out, and it's 25 pages long. And he talks all about what it was like to be captured and what it was like to be brought and to live in this place. And frankly, it's 23 pages of nonstop reference to how hungry he is and how terrible the food is and how they're sleeping under blankets with holes in them that are covered in maggots. So it was a difficult time. You know, he manages to survive Gettysburg, but then somehow has to spend the next 2 years living in these horrible conditions. And thankfully for him, manages to make it out. A lot of people didn't make it out of Libby.
This is Nathaniel Rollins.
We reached the building known as Libby Prison at about dark. We had been searched one by one, and every article of value, including blankets, knapsacks, haversacks, etc., were taken from us and were never returned. The officer in charge gave each prisoner one blanket each, these all being blankets taken from our own men, and mostly old and badly worn, beside being very dirty. The authorities had our rations prepared for us by some Negro cooks. At this time, a ration for one man consisted of one half loaf of wheat bread. Then, for dinner, there was served about 2/3 of a bowl of rice soup. This was made by boiling either fresh beef or bacon, and, when nearly cooked, putting in some rice. Either from ignorance of the proper method of cooking or from design, neither the meat or the rice was washed. When bacon was served, it was old and, having been badly cured, was very maggoty. The rice was all dirt and worms. It was by no means an unusual thing to find from 10 to 20 maggots and worms in a tin cup of soup. This much food was not enough to satisfy the wants of any man unless he was too sick to eat. Not once during the first 3 months of my imprisonment did I leave the table without feeling as hungry or hungrier than when going to my meals, except when sick. Soon boxes from home came, so there were but few who were dependent on rebel rations. But here came another trouble. Friends in the North secreted money in the boxes, and from some source the rebel authorities found this out. When every package came, it was subjected to the closest inspection, and all monies found, confiscated. This precaution was carried still farther, and they refused to allow the boxes taken upstairs at all, but required the claimants of the box to go to the lower floor and there acknowledge the receipt of the box and contents in good condition. I remember a Lieutenant Moran who got a box which must have weighed 150 pounds, and after so acknowledging its receipt in good condition, he went out with his blanket to get the contents, and all that was left for him was one tin pipe and a piece of brown paper, all which was taken from prisoners under a promise on the part of the rebel officers to return it as needed, was, in nearly every case, kept by them, and when I was released, December 10, 1864, every effort to get either the money or any satisfactory answer respecting it had been in vain. More than 17 months of prison life had made such words as going home sound strange. We embarked and steamed toward Fort Sumter. As we passed Fort Sumter, the heavy mist lifted from the water, and for the first time for so many months, we saw our flag floating from the mast of the ship New York. Immediately, our song, the Star-Spangled Banner, rang out from a thousand voices till that rebel steamer seemed almost to have become loyal, and the host of happy men forgot their hunger, their troubles, and knew and thought of nothing but their flag, their country, and their homes.
That's Wisconsin soldier Nathaniel Rawlins taken prisoner after the Battle of Gettysburg, as read by Peter Sobel. It's a very detailed account of what he went through there and what a sort of treasure trove of information you can find in those sorts of accounts and letters.
He also had beautiful handwriting, which is also not the case for all people in the 19th century or today. But, you know, considering his ordeal and everything, it's beautifully written and, yeah, just a very moving account of what it must have been like.
On the lighter side, where did old Abe come into the Civil War? I don't mean the president. I mean the mascot.
So old Abe was the mascot of the 8th Wisconsin Regiment. They were known as the Eagle Regiment. They weren't the only regiment, actually, in the Civil War to have an animal mascot, though they were perhaps the old Abe was perhaps the most famous. Some other regiments in other states had live bears, goats, cows. I'm not quite sure why you would bring one of these
animals. Cow I can see, maybe even the goat. Some of the other things I'm not, the badger I don't think I'd bring along.
They are kind of vicious, though.
Maybe just the symbolic.
It's true, yeah. Yeah. I see the eagle, though, you know, the eagle as the symbol of the United States. I'm less sure, though, about what the goat symbolizes. But anyway, this eagle, old Abe, he'd been captured by an Indian on the Flambeau River, and he was eventually bought by some men in Eau Claire. And when the Civil War began, they brought their eagle along with them. And old Abe really became a symbol of this regiment. He went into every battle with the men. One of the soldiers was assigned to protecting him. He would sit on his perch, and they would make sure that he came through the battle okay, too. And he became really well known. People would look out for old Abe. It was fun for people. You would often see in letters people commenting that they saw this famous eagle. And after the Civil War, old Abe remained kind of a hero. He went and lived in the basement of the Capitol on a perch there, and people would come and visit him and, you know, pay their respects to him. And at Civil War reunions, people would often, they'd often bring old Abe along because it, you know, brought back good memories, and he was such a symbol of this, you know, important war that all of these men had been through together.
Were his wings clipped? Is that why he didn't just fly away?
Yes. Yes. Yeah, they did clip his wings. So maybe he really wanted to fight in the battle. I don't know. So old Abe actually, unfortunately, died of some smoke inhalation. There was a fire in his room in the Capitol in 1881. They actually stuffed him. And so people could still go visit old Abe. And then that old Abe burned down with our Capitol in Madison in 1904. There were some recreations of his body made that you can actually, I think there's one at the Veterans Museum here in Madison. You can go see the replica of old Abe.
So. We'll look further at the transformation of Wisconsin by the Civil War when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Erica Janik, and we're talking about Wisconsin in the Civil War. You've mentioned a few changes that occurred in Wisconsin because of the Civil War. For example, the fact that more women are playing roles on farms or, you know, just having to occupy sort of vacuums that are there with all the men that are gone. What are some of the other changes that happen in Wisconsin as a result of the Civil War?
I think the biggest one that actually happens is something that happens in agriculture. And it's not directly tied to the Civil War in the fact that the fighting itself wasn't necessarily affecting this industry. But as I mentioned, Wisconsin had been a big wheat-growing state. A lot of immigrants came to Wisconsin and got into wheat farming because it was easy. It was low cost to get started. You could get 2 harvests a year. You know, this is a great entry point for people who don't have much trying to make a living in this place. Unfortunately, though, wheat is really hard on the soil. And so, you know, it's very hard to sustain a lot of yield of wheat year after year after year. And starting in the 1850s and the 1860s, people are moving further west, and they're planting wheat too. So while crop prices are really rising a lot at the beginning of the Civil War, we're facing a lot of competition from people living in Iowa and on the Great Plains, places that are also really fantastic for growing wheat and in some ways probably a little bit better. So some of the farmers are really starting to think that this maybe isn't such a good idea. And something that really changes their mind is we get an infestation of this cinch bug, and it really devastates the wheat crops in the state. It really devastates everyone. If they weren't already devastated by the war, then all of the work that they'd been putting into their land was really gone by these bugs. The state had actually been trying to convince farmers for years that they needed to grow something other than just wheat. But again, it's hard to convince people of this. So there had been a few people, you know, trying orcharding. There was a hops craze in Sauk County. You know, people were trying various things, but on the whole, still a wheat state. This man, William Dempster Hoard, moves to Wisconsin in the 1850s. He's from upstate New York. He kind of sees what's going on around Wisconsin, and he thinks that dairying might be Wisconsin's future. He had, where he'd come from in New York at the time was probably the dairy state, and he'd seen a lot of how it could really work really well on that kind of soil and that kind of climate, which is actually kind of similar to how Wisconsin is. And so he really began advocating that Wisconsin switch to a dairy state. Let's not do these crops anymore. Let's start raising livestock. This is a hard transition for a lot of farmers to make. Raising crops and then raising animals are two different things. But he begins to really tirelessly advocate for moving toward dairy. And he really pushes farmer education, scientific farming. He organizes a Wisconsin Dairymen's Association, a state organization to kind of help farmers make this transition more easily. He works really closely with the university. The University of Wisconsin plays a very active role in promoting dairy. And he's really successful. I mean, by the turn of the 20th century, 90% of Wisconsin farms have cows on them.
If we're talking 1860s, 1870s, though, without a very sophisticated refrigeration, are we talking mostly cheese, which would keep better than milk?
Yep, that's right. You know, cheese was more difficult to make. Butter was actually fairly easy to make, but without any kind of real transportation infrastructure and any kind of cooling system, it really wouldn't keep at all. I think Wisconsin was very fortunate because a lot of our settlers were from New England and New York and had some cheesemaking skills and background that they brought with them to Wisconsin, not to mention all of the European immigrants we were getting from Switzerland and Germany who also had come from dairying backgrounds and began bringing their cheesemaking skills with them to Wisconsin. So Wisconsin became known for making cheese because we didn't have refrigerated cars. And even though we were kind of at the end of the railroad line, transportation in Wisconsin was pretty dodgy. You know, it was hard to get around this place. It took, you know, basically until the late 19th century before Wisconsin was fairly easy to get around. The railroads were slow and spreading out. You know, they'd run out of money, and so the railroad line would just stop. People in Wisconsin were really wild for canals for a few years. People trying to connect the Mississippi River with Milwaukee, thinking they could dig a canal across the state. You know, ambitious ideas, but perhaps not realizing what quite that endeavor would be. Hoard actually really helped bring some of these refrigerated cars to Wisconsin and, you know, figuring out how we could bring out more of our product and help get farmers at higher prices.
What about the political effects of the Civil War on Wisconsin? Do you think it brought the state together in terms of feeling more of a sense of unity, or did it create a kind of polarized situation, or both?
I think a little bit of both. I think for the most part, I think it did really – the war really did bring people together and feeling like they had all gone through this great endeavor together and that they'd survived it together. And so people were really feeling proud of their country and proud that they had been a part of it. That really continued into the, you know, as the Civil War soldiers were coming back, there were all kinds of reunions. There was this real feeling of fellowship among people. So I think it did, you know, really help bring a lot of people together. But people being people, as the war gets, you know, further along, there's new immigrants coming from other places, that new challenges to face. There's economic recession several times in the late 19th century, too. That prosperity we'd been feeling from the Civil War, you know, war causes a lot of industries to really ramp up. And then when the war is over, well, you've ramped up, but now there's nowhere for all that stuff to go. And so that caused some recessions in Wisconsin. The Republican Party still remained very strong in Wisconsin, though, as well as nationally, you know.
About 20 years?
Yep. So, you know, I think the Civil War had some long-lasting fellow feeling, I think, that did carry on for several years. But I do think, you know, as the war got further into the distance, some more cracks started appearing.
And if you travel around Wisconsin now, besides seeing Camp Randall Stadium, besides seeing like a statue of a colonel, you know, near the Capitol, what evidence can you find of the Civil War?
I think some of the Underground Railroad sites, there are places where, like I mentioned, the Milton House, you can see where slaves were kind of hidden in homes and kind of get a feel for the routes that they went on. You know, there's a lot of homes still in the state that were around at that time where you can kind of get a sense of what people were living in and what their daily lives were like.
Those great octagonal limestone houses, or those left.
One in Janesville. Yeah, the octagon houses were very big. That was actually something that started coming up before the Civil War. There's a guy who was actually one of the leading phrenologists, one of those people that read the bumps on your head, named Orson Fowler, and he was a big proponent of the octagon house. And he actually, I just learned this the other day, I was very excited, that he had first seen his first octagon house in Wisconsin, and he became a big proponent of octagon houses nationally as this real healthful way of living because there was lots of space, so the air was flowing around, and it was so much better. So octagon houses were kind of a craze in the 1850s. There was a big one here in Wisconsin.
In Madison. For quite a long time, then it was finally demolished.
Right. That's actually where Cordelia Harvey had her hospital, was in that octagon house. And then after the war, Cordelia's hospital became an orphanage for children whose fathers were killed in the Civil War. So she really, after the war, kind of kept fighting for families and trying to do the best she could to provide for people. That effort among many women didn't really end with the war. They really were involved in a lot of reform efforts for health and cleanliness.
We should add that her husband, who was the governor of Wisconsin, lost his life during the war, but not in uniform.
That's right. Yeah, he went down to visit some Wisconsin troops and somehow misstepped and actually drowned. It's kind of tragic. And that was very early in the war. And she, you know, kept fighting. She knew that her husband was a big supporter of the Union cause, and so she became a big advocate of the Union, as that letter you read about her interaction with Lincoln. You know, she really had traveled around a lot and seen soldiers in these southern hospitals, and she just looked around and thought, there is no way people are getting healthy in this climate. The only way they can get healthy is if they come back to the North. And part of why Lincoln was really exasperated with her, despite her, he had other things to do, and she was very persistent. But he also really worried that if soldiers went back to the North, that they would desert. Because if you were brought back home, why in the world would you go back?
Once you were wounded and you'd had enough of this, you're home.
Yeah, so... But she was, you know, very, very persistent, and she managed to convince them to start this hospital here in Madison. But, yeah, so she's quite a woman.
What surprised you the most looking into Wisconsin in the Civil War?
I actually think, you know, one of the things that's very surprising to me is, again, I think as I've mentioned too, that we don't think of Wisconsin as a Civil War state, but how much it affected every single person who lived here. Wisconsin men fought in every single battle. Women were out traveling around trying to do what they could to help the war, serving as nurses or as part of these sanitary commissions, looking at health and cleanliness and the quality of the food. That people were really actively engaged with this cause that was, for the most part, happening pretty far away from home, yet people were, you know, really dedicated to it and really following it and knew exactly what was happening. I think that's something that's a little surprising.
Did the war, as it did in so many other instances, produce people who would become major figures in Wisconsin politics? I mean, for a long time, that was the touchstone for success in politics. Were you in the war?
Right. Yep, definitely. Lucius Fairchild lost his arm, becomes the governor. Definitely a lot of prominent Wisconsin generals become legislators, become governors, become mayors. That's definitely a good thing to have on your resume that you fought in the Civil War.
Lasting effect on race in this state?
Well, actually, in 1865, Sherman Booth, that abolitionist troublemaker, convinces an African-American man named Ezekiel Gillespie, who had been a slave in the South and who moved to Milwaukee. He had purchased his freedom. And Sherman Booth was, you know, pretty tired of the fact that African-Americans couldn't vote, despite the fact that Wisconsin residents said they could. So he convinced Gillespie to go try to vote and see what would happen. And of course, Gillespie was refused. And so this case went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and the Wisconsin Supreme Court voted unanimously to allow African Americans to vote. And so Wisconsin actually became one of the very first states to allow African Americans to vote. And this time it actually worked. With the Supreme Court weighing in, there was really not a lot of stops that people could say about the majority thing again, and what did this all mean? So I think things did improve in some ways, but there's still a lot of challenges ahead.
Erica Janik, thanks for giving us a look at Wisconsin during the Civil War.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.